the system set up now is that we borrow it from this private corporation called the Federal Reserve, and then we have to pay the money back plus interest. And what did the Federal Reserve do to get that money? Absolutely nothing. They just sent it over to the United States printing office and said, print us up some money. And it basically cost them 3 cents to get a $100 bill. So they get this $100 bill, lend it to the United States government, and then you and I have to pay it back. It is that fraudulent and that blatant. And of course, they don't actually print up the money. I think the money out there in circulation, about 97% of the money in circulation, it just exists as data entries in computers and so forth. And it's only about 3% of the money supply is actually coins and dollar bills and so forth.
Yeah, but what you're saying applies to all of it.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that it's not just the cash, the burned cash. It's also all the bank account money and the electronic and so on. I mean, that's all issued, as far as I know, by the Federal Reserve.
Yes, correct. Absolutely.
And it applies, and on all of it, interest is owing. Not only that, it's interest that is set by the Federal Reserve.
Exactly.
Talk about a good gig.
Well, it certainly is. It's a system that benefits both the politicians in control as well as the bankers. So the bankers win, the politicians win. They're able to do all their pork barrel schemes and so forth, and roll merrily along. And you know, they can have wars the way they want them. Used to be in the old days when the country had a war, they had to go sell it to the American people. This is before 1913. They had to go to the American people, say, hey, we've got a great war for you, so please don't mind our new taxes, and would you please buy these bonds? They had to go begging hat in hand. No longer with the Federal Reserve. Now they just merely print up the money. The money increases in circulation, and everybody's been nipped. Talk about a regressive tax. Inflation is a highly regressive tax. It gets right down to the poorest of the poor. So I think what you're pointing out, Tom, is this whole system is really incredible what you're talking about, and I think it's highly relevant. So that book is called Cracking the Code.
And they don't have an author on it, by the way.
Oh, really?
It's published by a team called the UCCSG, the UCC Service Group. And they don't, probably because the guy wants to save his neck. I mean, he probably is just as soon not be assassinated, whoever. Or it probably is a team effort. But I mean, they don't put their names on it because there's such explosive material. I haven't read anything about anything to do with this government or any government that's anywhere near as explosive as the information contained in that book.
Well, it certainly is. You know, in the kind of civilization we live in, basically money is power. And I think it is the heart and guts of politics. What was it, Unruh up in Sacramento there many years ago? Is he the fellow that said, money is the mother's milk of politics, and really, in this system we have, money controls just everything. As a society, as an overall society, where we put our money determines the direction of the country goes, and just the same on an individual basis. You know, how much money you have determines quite a bit the quality of your life. And as a society, we're taking our money votes, and I think spending it and going and voting in highly erroneous directions. But that's what this phony money system allows the politicians and the banksters to do. And so understanding money, I mean, all this that you're talking about, cracking the code and so forth, really goes back to solidifying this whole corrupt monetary system when you really get down to it. It's all revolving around protecting the money system and power. And it's a hidden basis for power. So I think understanding what you're talking about, certainly if you go into a court, you would like to have some awareness of this. I think you'd probably have to study a lot more than what we've talked about here on the radio to be helpful. But perhaps someone out there listening could if they're having concerns in this direction, could get that book and at least have some basis when they go into a courtroom to start talking. Well, Tom, I see we're getting towards the end of our program here. Do you want to maybe just tell people how they can get a hold of that book?
Okay, I'll be happy to.
You have about a half a minute to do that.
Okay, it's a BBCOA. I haven't actually visited that website, but it's BB as in boy, COA.com is the website, and the number in the valley is 818-754-8611.
Great.
And you can leave messages there, and they'll answer you. You know, you leave a message that you want to buy the book and so on or whatever, and they will answer you in due course.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom.
Well, James Morgan is spending actually just a little bit of radio feedback there, not so much. Otherwise, pretty darn smooth.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being because we have with us on the line Kathleen Duell. We're going to be talking about the cancer cover-up. Kathleen, are you there?
I'm here, Dr. Stan.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us again tonight. And Kathleen has a fascinating story to tell about the fact that there really are treatments for cancer that have been intentionally covered up for many years. Now, why would anybody want to do that? Well, people say, oh, well, you know, it's for money. And I don't believe that for one minute. I don't believe the average doctor. I know doctors, and they would never withhold treatment. But if they didn't understand what the treatments were, they certainly didn't understand what the agenda was, then, of course, they could very well be deceived. And this is one of the big problems we have in the practice of medicine today. The doctor knows what he reads in the medical journals, but you see, if the people who are financing the medical journals, the large drug companies, have a vested interest in keeping information out of the journals, it'll never be published. And, you know, then is the doctor going to learn? Is he going to learn that at the medical meetings? Not necessarily. If there is an agenda, why, he's never going to hear them at the medical meetings because somebody will pay the people who put the medical meetings on. And I hate to sound as if I think there's a conspiracy, but having been at this business for a long period of time and knowing full well that there is another agenda behind so much of what goes on, there really is a cancer cover-up. There are treatments that have been around for a long time. So I'm going to let Kathleen tell you about her work. I think that when she got started in this, she had no idea what it was all about. She has a very personal interest in this today. Kathleen, why don't you tell the story?
Well, I'm happy to. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. As you know, I've written a book called Cancer Cover-Up, and it's the story of my husband's treatment of his own cancer and helping many, many thousands of other people get to a place where they could also treat their cancers with two all-natural substances that were fighting cancers and building immune systems in these folks' bodies to the point where their body could take on the fight, and many, many lives were saved. And it really all started when my husband and I kind of stumbled into the fact that there are alternatives out here for many things, not just cancer, but for autoimmune system problems, et cetera. You know, we were mainline, you know, just regular American people brought up like anybody else to believe in, you know, our doctors and the system that's out there. And I had gotten very sick and had been sick for 9 years and had six surgeries and doctor after doctor and medication after medication and not able to sleep and in terrible pain and discomfort 24 hours a day, and all my muscles were wrecked and my joints were affected, and the doctors just weren't able to help me. They weren't able to diagnose me. They just kept feeding me more and more drugs, more and more treatments, more and more surgeries, and I was just so ill that I was really, I believe, losing the battle. And when someone introduced me to magnetic technology, which literally, I believe, saved my life and changed my life forever and certainly gave me back my quality of life. And it was only then, when I was 49 years old, that I realized, my gosh, there's a whole other world out here besides the medical arena. There's so much to learn and so much to know about how it affects your body and so forth, and I just started helping other people with the same products that I had been helped with. And as time went on, you know, my reputation built and people started calling me just out of referrals from other people. And one day a gentleman named Alan Hoffman called and said he'd like to come over and meet with me and my husband. And what he had been doing for the last couple of years in Baltimore, Maryland, was using a highly concentrated form of aloe vera on AIDS patients. Now, Alan Hoffman was not an MD. He was a biochemist. He had headed up several laboratories at Johns Hopkins University. For many years, he had worked there and been involved in all kinds of studies and just different things. And so he told us of his background. He told us that he'd been reading an old medical journal one day, and in that medical journal, he learned that highly concentrated aloe vera was apparently like a pharmacy in a plant. There were so many things that that affect the body when you put this kind of concentrated aloe vera into it, just 138 different things that are addressed in the body by this kind of a concentration. And what he was learning from these journals that he was reading, and he went and pulled many other journals. In fact, he was able to find over 100 articles and journals on the subject of aloe vera and what it could do for cancer and AIDS. Primarily AIDS is what the first journal he read that got his attention. And what he was learning is that the aloe vera was building the patient's immune system to the point where they were manufacturing T cells again. And when that happened, the symptoms of the virus, the AIDS virus, just, I guess, kind of went to rest in the body, as did their symptoms for herpes, which so many AIDS patients suffer from. And in addition to that, Kaposi sarcoma, which is a deadly skin cancer, which many of these people die from, just disappeared. That was his that was his experience in using the product. Once he read these articles, he went out and he worked with some people that grow aloe, and he worked on a formula, kept working and working until he got it to the point where he was seeing the same kinds of results with people that he was treating in Baltimore.
How could he treat patients? Was he treating them sort of under the counter? Was he working with a doctor there? How was he able to actually treat patients without a medical degree?
He actually sought out, well, actually, you know, he wasn't these patients were just drinking this. It wasn't anything giving them.
They were just drinking the aloe vera.
Right, but he did get these patients by a referral from other doctors.
All right, fine.
In Baltimore. He went seeking out doctors that he knew, and he knew many doctors because of his experience at Johns Hopkins. And so he was led to patients, and he started telling these patients about this protocol, and they started taking it with just remarkable results, to the point where many of these patients were actually able to go back to work again and hold real jobs again because their symptoms just kind of disappeared. They were building T cells originally in about the first 3 weeks of taking the protocol. They would only build one or two T cells. After 3 or 4 weeks, they would have 10 or 20 T cells. But after 3, 4, 5, 6 months down the road, and it varied in all people, they would have hundreds of T cells. And so they were back actually able to enjoy a normal life again. And when he came to us, the reason for coming to us was he had heard of what we were doing, and so therefore he knew that we were enjoying helping people with magnetic technology. And he said, I'd like to introduce you to what I do, and I'd like to know if you would back us, back me financially. And so my husband, being very entrepreneurial, my husband's a physicist and an engineer, and he's also been trained as an attorney, although he's never really practiced as one, but he's a brilliant guy, and he was very, very interested in what Alan was doing because for much of his life, he worked on a lot of what I call black box stuff for our government, where he was aiding in building weapons of mass destruction. And now, after my illness and seeing what the results were that I'd gotten from the technologies I was using, he was just feeling so much better about being able to go out and help people instead of doing the kind of work he had spent his life doing. So he gave Alan Hoffman $200,000 to go out and have the product manufactured in larger quantities so that he could begin to help other people. My husband formed a business with Alan, and they immediately started using this aloe protocol to help other people. In the meantime, Alan was also going outside the country, and he was giving this protocol to people intravenously and having stunning results. And the reason he did that out of the country was because so many people that came to him were so late stage in their disease that the only way that he thought he could really help them and give them any extension to their life was to give it to them intravenously because then it reacts in the body that much better and quicker. So while he was doing that and recording phenomenal results, my husband was also doing more research and stumbled across some information in a couple of books that I had given him reading about cesium. Now, cesium is on the periodic table. It's number 55 on the table. It's the Earth's most alkaline element. There's no mineral on Earth more alkaline than cesium is. And he read about another brilliant physicist, a Dr. Keith Brewer, and the works that he had been doing with cesium in treating cancer patients. And Dr. Keith Brewer, who was very elderly at the time he started doing work on cesium, had read Otto Warburg's works. Otto Warburg was a doctor in Germany who back in 1925 wrote a paper on the fact that cancer is anaerobic. It cannot live in a high oxygen environment. And so he was actually given a Nobel Prize for that paper in 1931. He, several years later, was also to be awarded another Nobel Prize, but Hitler would not allow him to accept it. So ever since 1925, when this paper was written, people right on up till today have been trying to figure out a way that they could introduce oxygen into a cancer cell to try to kill it. And, you know, you've heard of many therapies out there. There's ozone therapy and hydrogen peroxide therapy and all different kinds of other therapies that they're playing with out there, but unfortunately, it wasn't working well. It wasn't getting it into the cancer cell. It might get it into the bloodstream, but not into the cancer cell itself. And yet, in 1984, Dr. Keith Brewer, who had studied the works of Wahlberg and who had also spent much of his career working in the mass spectroscopy labs for our United States government, and did nothing but watch the cell membrane and see what it allows to enter into a cell and why it does and why it doesn't and how it does it, how it won't do it in some circumstances. That's what he spent his life's work on, and he thought, my gosh, if I could get cesium, the most alkaline element on Earth, into a cancer cell, it would alkalize that cancer cell to the extent, I think, that it could damage or destroy it. And what he had to do was he had to find a way to make that happen. And so after years and years of trying, he came upon a formula for just using simple antioxidants like zinc and vitamin C. I believe he also used some potassium. And that allowed, when taken with the cesium, that allowed the cell membrane to open up, accept this very large molecule of cesium, and close back down around it. So now the cesium is in the cancer cell, and it can't get out again. It doesn't have a way to now get out, so it sits there. And there's a whole long formula that relates to what happens next, but in essence what happens is the cell becomes alkalized. The cesium donates its alkalinity to the cancer cell, raising the pH of that cell to 8. And, I must mention here that one cannot dicker around with the pH of a normal, healthy cell. The body has a very elaborate buffering system for keeping that from happening. One could die if one tries to fool around with the pH of a healthy cell. But once a cell becomes malignant, the body no longer protects it. And so when this large cesium molecule enters into a cancer cell and sits there and alkalizes the cell, it raises the pH of that cell to 8, which translates to oxygenating the cell, and it immediately dies. It cesium goes through the body like a heat-seeking missile, looking for nothing but acidic tissue to donate its alkalinity to. It does not bother healthy tissue. So, for example, when you take chemo, we all know that chemo doesn't just destroy a cancer cell, it destroys healthy cells along with it, tearing your immune system down to the point where you can't fight anything off. And so many people die from any kind of an infection that comes down the pike, or a pneumonia or a cold or whatever, because they don't have an immune system left to fight anything off with. But cesium, and what's amazing to me is, because the medical arena knows this.
No, I don't think the average doctor knows that at all.
Well, no, the average doctor doesn't.
And the average oncologist doesn't know it. There certainly would be some of the scientists who know it. Some people working behind the scenes probably in the FDA know it. But the average doctor doesn't know of anything about these things.
Well,
he never will read about them.
What I was going to say is what they do know about is that when they want to send chemo directly to a specific point in the body, to a specific tumor, they mark it with radioactive. It's radioactive. There are two kinds of cesium. There's regular cesium chloride that comes out of the earth in the form of a salt, and there is radioactive cesium. And so when they want to put a marker at a tumor and so that they can get the chemotherapy directly to that tumor marker, they use radioactive cesium in very, very tiny amounts. Why do they do that? Because they understand that cesium only has an affinity for malignant tissue.
Okay. But then carrying that over, nobody's told them that this can actually be beneficial. At least I don't think the average doctor would have any idea about that.
Oh,
so,
I'm sure you're right, because every doctor we've spoken to looks at us as though we're speaking a foreign language.
And yet this is written up in some medical journals in the past?
Oh, absolutely. It was written up by Dr. Keith Brewer in 1984. And in fact, what he did, he spent years working on mice and rats. And when he was sure he really had something, he actually did use the cesium and his antioxidant theory on 30 cancer patients. Now, all 30 of these patients had exhausted all traditional methods. They all had between 2 weeks and 2 months to live, and they were all in the final stages of cancer. There was nothing left for them to try. Everything else had been done. And he gave them cesium, and a remarkable thing happened. Within 12 to 36 hours of taking the cesium, all of their pain disappeared.
Well, now, what happened to the use of cesium after that? Did he publish the paper?
He published the paper, and then there was a Dr. Sartori, who slightly after that, after Brewer did his studies, Dr. Sartori did his studies on 50 patients. The first 14 patients died, but they were very, very, very sick and ill, and they really didn't have a chance to live. But the other 36 patients survived. And in Brewer's case, a year later, those 30 patients that he worked with were still alive and cancer-free.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment or two with Kathleen Dowell. Let her tell her story. It's an amazing story. We'll comment on this when we get back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest today is Kathleen Dowell. We're talking about her book, The Cancer Cover-Up. And, of course, she and her husband, or at least her husband, was involved in this company that was were they actually marketing the aloe vera, or were they marketing the cesium here in the United States?
Yes, initially they were marketing the aloe vera in 2-ounce bottles, and they were selling it for $75 a bottle.
And then how often did you have to drink the aloe vera?
Well, the aloe vera, they simply suggested that you could take a capful a day, which was about a teaspoon a day, and just take it on a daily basis. Now, people who were very, very ill might have taken 2 or 3 teaspoons a day and then weaned back down to 1 a day.
Now, was it really helping the AIDS cases? Is it ever written up scientifically, do you know?
Well, it was written up in some journals, which is how Alan Hoffman discovered all of it.
Okay.
And a lot of this work was done by Reg McDaniels and a Dr. McAnally down in Texas. And in fact, there's a lot of things that came out in the trial that Alan Hoffman and my husband eventually endured. All kinds of work that was done with AIDS patients using highly concentrated aloe vera, and not to mention the fact that there were safety studies done by the government themselves on 50 medical students or pre-med students at the University of Texas in Houston, where they gave IV aloe vera to these 50 medical students without any sign of toxicity in aloe vera whatsoever.
Oh, I know.
Totally
eventually down the line, why, of course, the product safety division there in, what was it, Maryland, where you lived?
Yes, the Consumer Protection Division.
Right, and of course, but basically, they said, well, you shouldn't make any claims that this is going to be helpful. Is that right?
That's right. What happened is Alan and my husband provided a brochure to people, and the brochure was about an 8-page piece, and in that brochure, they put all the information that they could pull from the different studies that they had found. And Alan had gone, you know, kind of underground, because much of this is not out in the open where you can find it. And all of these papers were presented at their trial. But they made a brochure up that simply said the most natural and powerful way to boost your immune system, tee up. And T-Up was the name of the product for upping the T-cells. and they simply told about aloe vera and in concentrated amounts what it was able to do for the body. And they talked about things like herpes, and they talked about what it could do for AIDS, and they talked about what it could do to help people with diabetes and blood pressure problems and cholesterol problems and things like that, and did not feel that they were doing anything incorrect because all of this was information that they had pulled from these studies. And so, obviously, the FDA came after them, and so, you know, my husband said, well, fine, we'll take the brochure off the market if you'll, you know, tell us what we've done wrong or what we shouldn't say, what we should pull out of it. We'll be happy to reprint it, and let's just sit down and have a meeting and decide what needs to be done.
Now, was this the FDA or was this the state?
Well, it was the state of Maryland, but it was being pushed by the FDA. That's who came to their offices.
We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we'll be back here with Kathleen Doolin and telling this amazing, amazing story. A very effective, apparently, product. And, of course, suddenly the FDA comes after them. And, of course, what was so incredible about this is they came up with a $4 million fine rather than just saying, all right, take this off the market. You know, you can't say these things. They came after the long and extensive trial. They fined your husband over $4 million, and he wasn't even involved in the company at this time?
No, my husband gave Alan Hoffman $200,000 to get the business started, primarily to get the products manufactured, and then he joined Alan. He sat in an office every day, but he didn't know that much about what Alan was doing in terms of the knowledge. He didn't have the scope of knowledge about the aloe that Alan did. What my husband was doing was other business. He was sitting on the telephone talking to other people about other things because he was interested in other businesses as well. And he was also talking to some people who had cancer that would come in, you know, talk to him. And he'd refer them to Alan because Alan was the expert in this. He took back the $200,000 in the form of a weekly salary. And so once he got his $200,000 back, he left the business. We continued to refer people to him anytime anyone happened to call us or ask us, gee, you know, do you know anything that we might be able to do to help our situation? Our son has cancer or our daughter has cancer, whatever. And we would simply say, have you heard about aloe vera and cesium? Because at that point they were also using the cesium. The aloe came first, and then shortly after that they started using the cesium as well.
Well, now, did the government force you to take the aloe vera off the market, this concentrated form you had?
Not at all.
It's still being sold.
It's still out there. You can buy aloe vera, and you can buy, T-Up isn't being... When we had it made by the grower, we called it T-Up. You can still get the product from the grower, but he doesn't call it T-Up. We called it that. It's just like any manufacturer sends a product out to the end user, and then they put their own label on it. So, you know, the aloe is still out there, and it's being used every day. I take it every day. My husband takes it every day. My family takes it every day. It is still on the market. And it's just incredible to me that we've got a $4.7 million levy against us for a product that never hurt anybody, that the Maryland Consumer Protection Division, the Attorney General of the state, brought us into court under that auspices of the Consumer Protection Division, and yet there wasn't one consumer in the state of Maryland that ever complained about the product.
Well, I think that you have to realize that this really all had to do with anything that is effective in treating cancers will be suppressed. And if you, out in the listening audience, you find that difficult to believe, let me point out that in 1980, a man named Dean Burke, Dr. Dean Burke, who was in charge of the chemotherapy research at the NIH, called me and returned my call. And he told me he'd been doing research on cancer treatments for over 25 years or more. He said there was a organized cover-up of effective cancer treatments. Now, this guy's calling me, Dr. Burke's calling from the National Cancer Institute. He's in charge of the division of chemotherapy. He told me that we were talking about Laetril. He said Laetril works. I have a whole probably half a dozen filing cabinets full of information on this, and it's a lot better than chemotherapy. Certainly the patients feel better. Certainly some patients are going to die. The cancer is so far advanced, nothing's going to help them. But I believe that Laetril is better than the cancer routine chemotherapy treatments. I said, what about the Sloan Kettering study that was done? Because, of course, I, as a physician, we'd always told that. And he said, they actually fixed that Sloan Kettering study to prove that Laetril didn't work, but it does. I can tell you that. And he said there is an organized effort to suppress effective treatments. Now, he ought to know he was that was his life, his study. But the average person finds it difficult to believe. Who could be that crass? Who could be that indifferent to human suffering? Who could want people to die of cancer? And if you have any question, you'll want to get my April newsletter. It'll be coming out. If you're already subscribed, fine. If you don't subscribe to it, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And ask for a copy of the April Radio Liberty newsletter. And I hope that after you've read that, why you want to get it on a regular basis. Again, the number 1-800-544-8927. This is one of the most amazing newsletters you've ever read. We have the documentation for everything that's there. And after hearing this program, I hope you'll be intrigued enough, because is there anyone out there who doesn't know somebody who's died of cancer, and usually a terrible, terrible death? So why don't you go ahead and give us a call? We'll be glad to send you that newsletter free of charge. Again, remember our number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because truly America is under attack today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon, or this evening, is Kathleen Dool. Kathleen, before we forget about it, how can people get your book, copies of your book, The Cancer Cover-Up?
Well, they can either call in to an 800 or to a toll-free number, or they can use the internet. The toll-free telephone number to call is 866-769-7961. And then there are two websites they can look at. My website is www.cassandrabooks.com, CassandraBooks.com. And my husband's website is www.cancer, and then put a hyphen, coverup.com.
All right, fine. And, of course, it's an incredible book. It's well done. And you get into a lot of the treatments that have been covered up during the years. You get into the hydrazine sulfate. You get into Hoxie. The AMA tried to buy the Hoxie treatment many, many years ago. But when Dr. Hoxie said, well, you've got to give it free of charge to people who can't afford it, why, Dr. Morris Fishbein, who had represented the AMA, we're talking about, 50 years ago. They suppressed that treatment. And you will find, in fact, if we have a transcript of an interview that was done with a doctor who had actually heard the whole story laid out by the former medical director of Planned Parenthood, Dr. Day. Dr. Gundigan heard a talk given in 1969, and we have a transcript of an interview because he actually took notes during this talk, an incredible one, talking about everybody's going to have to die of cancer. We might as well let them die of cancer, and we, speaking of Planned Parenthood and this whole population control agenda group, we are going to suppress these treatments, and we're going to keep them locked up at the Rockefeller Institute. Fascinating, fascinating information. And, of course, you can actually get the transcript to us. Hopefully soon you'll be able to get the actual videotape. I have a personal interview with Dr. Dunnigan, but it isn't as good as the one that was done in 1988 by Randy Engel. Anyway, we'll go ahead and pick up the story from there, Kathleen. This trial, you weren't allowed a trial by jury. They put in the judge appointed by the attorney general who was trying you, and it really was a very much of a farce, wasn't it?
Well, it was something that was quite unexpected, and of course, with my husband being an attorney, I mean, you know, we hired the finest attorneys and we could find in Baltimore, a father-daughter team, and we went to them, we told them the whole story, and they said, you are going to lose this case. And not only that, you are going to lose any appeal connected to this case.
Because the courts were slightly corrupt.
Well, because it was not in a court of law as you and I know it. It was in an administrative hearings court run by a magistrate that works and is appointed by the Attorney General of Maryland.
Who was, of course, bringing the case against you.
Exactly. And we just looked at them and said, well, you're crazy. We haven't done anything wrong. We haven't hurt anybody. We're honest people. We're not even making money on the product, per se. I mean, it's $75 a bottle, for God's sakes. People would be selling this for $1,000 a bottle if they knew what it could do. So we said, no, we are going to stand on our principle, and we are going to fight this thing, and we want the world to know what this is. Anybody, you can grow aloe all over the world. We'll teach people. We'll give them the formula. We don't care. We could help the whole AIDS epidemic in Africa just by growing aloe over there and giving it to them.
But you don't understand. That's not what the agenda is. The agenda is
exactly.
To kill off as many people as you can. And if you doubt that, you'll want to get my latest newsletter, which simply quotes what these people have actually said as far as what they want to do. But go ahead.
Well, we were in an administrative hearings court, and for anybody that doesn't understand what that is, it's strictly, in the state of Maryland at least, it's a place where basically drunk drivers and drug addicts who lose their license go to lose their license. I mean, 96% of the cases that are heard in that court are traffic cases. And then the other 4% are just weird old, strange little cases. And then there was ours, which was a 6-month trial heard by a gal who had only been a magistrate for 8 months. And the only requirement for her to be a magistrate was that she needed to be a lawyer for at least 3 years. She had absolutely no experience in a case of this magnitude, which the attorney general called the biggest alternative medicine case in the history of the United States. When our lawyers would object vigorously to whatever, she would literally hold her hand up and to say, wait a minute, and start flipping through this 6-inch thick book to try to figure out how she could explain why she was, you know, whether she was going to sustain or overrule the objection. There were days when she actually left the bench in tears because she was in so far over her head she just did not know what she was doing. When the case was first brought, she met with the attorneys and she said, all right, the state has 12 witnesses, so that's all I'm allowing for you, us, our side. And we said, well, wait a minute. You've brought 38 counts against us. We have to address all 38 counts. We've got at least one witness for each count we should be allowed. And she said, you get 12, they get 12. That's it. And so we were allowed to bring 12 witnesses. I mean, how ridiculous when you've got 38 counts against you. They never took the product off the market, and they never found one person with 770,000 MDs in this country and another couple of hundred thousand PhDs. They couldn't bring in one witness in my husband's trial and Alan's trial to testify against cesium. Nobody knows about it. We had two people from Johns Hopkins at the trial. One was the head of oncology and infectious diseases. The other, who had spent his whole career, 35 years, at Hopkins. The other guy was a doctor who headed up the AIDS clinic at Johns Hopkins. And when we asked the first guy if he knew the second guy, he said, no, should I? And yet both of these guys were working on AIDS and doing studies, and yet in 35 years, the first guy didn't know who the second guy was. In Johns Hopkins. I mean, it was just amazing. And yet when you asked any of them, what experience do you have using highly concentrated aloe vera in human beings? None. what knowledge do you have of what highly concentrated aloe vera will do to the human body? None. And yet they won the case. It was just extraordinary. It was like a B movie.
But of course, then when you appeal the case, you go up to another administrative court that is under the control of the same corrupt regime.
Yes, it just goes up one step higher above the judge or the magistrate that heard the case in the first place.
Well, what about an appeal beyond that?
We went one more appeal. There's one more appeal beyond that that would then shift you over into a real, I guess it's circuit court, but it was denied. And it was denied just as our lawyers had told us it would be. And we just couldn't believe it. I mean, we couldn't believe that they could have known in advance. And they said, it's because of the system. They said, we know that. And they researched for us the cases that had been heard in that administrative hearings court in the 10 years since that court has been in existence. And there hasn't been one case that has been won by the plaintiff.
And
all of the cases were won by the government.
And I think that what people have to understand is that, well, you go back and you read the Bible, 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter, and what happened, why the courts were corrupt, and so, of course, the judges, they happened to be Samuel's sons, and, of course, the people came and said, look, your sons are corrupt, our society is corrupt, and when the courts are corrupt, we want a king. And that was, of course, how it came that Saul became the king of Israel. But up to that time, the people were free. But when the courts were corrupted, they began looking for an alternative. Instead of trying to clean up the courts, they did away with their form of government. And my fear is this same thing could happen right here in the United States. Well, anyway, let's pick up the story from there. So, Kathleen, now you then and out trying to tell people about the cancer cover-up. What are some of the other treatments that have been effectively covered up in the United States where they've had excellent results, haven't hurt anybody, people have been literally brought back from the grave, and yet, of course, these treatments are effectively suppressed here in the United States because there really are wicked people out there who do want people to die. Go ahead and tell the story.
Well, for example, I've got a couple of different things I can talk about. One is a gentleman, a doctor, who spent his career, about 35 years, at the National Cancer Institute. National Cancer Institute. And he was diagnosed with his own cancer about 27 years ago. It was NIH. I'm so sorry. It's late tonight out here on the East Coast.
Are you by any chance on a headset or are you on a hardline telephone?
I'm on a hardline telephone.
Okay, go ahead.
And he was at the NIH for 35 years, and when he was diagnosed with his own cancer 27 years ago, the doctors there told him that he had a very rare form of cancer and that he had probably 2 to 4 months to live. They wanted to throw the book at him, give him chemo, radiation, etc. And he said, no. He said, I'm not going to do that. And instead, he went to the libraries there, and he pulled all of the information on Harry Hoxie's formula. And he went and made the formula himself. And he saved his own life. He's still alive today. He's in his 90s. And I just recently met him. People brought him to me and introduced him to me, and he told me his story, and I stood there flabbergasted, and I said, let me ask you something. Did you help other people with your formula? And he said, in the first 15 years, I didn't help anyone outside of the NIH because I saw what they did to Harry Hoxie, and I was very afraid. But he said, when they saw the results that I had, many of the doctors and even the oncologists at the NIH sought me out for their own cancers.
Do you think we could get him to come onto our radio program?
I will try for you.
I would love to have him. I wish Dean Burke was still alive, Dr. Burke, from the NCI, National Cancer Institute. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to interview him before he died and immortalized his amazing story, the number one man in cancer chemotherapy research telling me that there were treatments that were being actively suppressed. Of course, he was demonized and marginalized, and
sure.
I've talked to people, this crazy Dr. Burke. Well, anybody who tells you the truth will be attacked. That's the tragedy, the reality of what's going on today. So anyway, this gentleman then helped many people at NCI, but they would not, or the National Institute of Health, but they would not authorize this for other people. Is that right?
That's exactly right. They have many of the cures there. I mean, let me tell you, the people at NIH know where the cures are and what they are, and they know how to use them. Even there is even a rice machine, as I understand it, one of the original rice machines that is there.
That was devised by Dr. Rice, and of course that treatment has been suppressed too through the years. And he had a very very powerful microscope, didn't he?
That's exactly right. Over 5,000 parts in that microscope, and it just did. It showed living organisms, not dead organisms, and it was quite incredible. And then through frequencies, he was able to kill cancers. He could actually see the cancer cells dying right before his eyes, very much like the work that Gaston Nessens in Canada is doing, working with almost the same kind of microscope, very close to what Rice had, where he can actually see the living microorganisms in his microscope, and then he knows how to treat them with a special formula that he's... I mean, there's so many different things out there. Dr. Joe Gold, up in Syracuse, I believe, is where he's located, who developed hydrazine sulfate. He actually worked on the space program, and hydrazine sulfate is actually a series of about five different chemicals that actually were... It was developed by him to fight cachexia in cancer patients. That's when cancer patients lose so much weight and they look anorexic and so forth. But by taking hydrazine sulfate, they would maintain an appetite and they wouldn't lose all that weight, and it would help them to, you know, stay healthier to fight the disease. And also, it happened to reduce tumors and even make some tumors disappear in some patients. And it is still today the number one cancer treatment that is used in Russia. And yet in this country, when he did his studies and used it on patients, he had remarkable success. When Sloan Kettering did a test, all of the patients died,
yeah,
over
of course,
500 patients.
But I'm sure that they fixed that just like they fixed the Leah studies,
they
did Dr. Brzezinski's studies. They fixed it to make sure that it wouldn't work, because they're part of this whole cancer cover-up. And I hate to say that, but Sloan Kettering certainly is not a clinic of integrity. And I would simply point out, we have an interview with Dr. Gold did the work with hydrazine sulfate. It's in our four-tape set on Genocide. You really want to get that tape set. It's a four-tape set on Genocide with Dr. Gold. And actually, people have done these other studies. We have a four-tape set on Laetrile. Why have a four-tape set on why do we still have cancer? And you'll be amazed when you actually go into the background of these things. There has been a conscious cover-up. And, of course, they are suppressing the treatment. You say, well, why would they do anything like that? Because there are evil and wicked people out there. And as one of them said, Dr. Day, who worked for Planned Parenthood, people are going to have to die of something. They might as well die of cancer. And if that is beyond your concept that people can be that evil, then you explain to me the great wars of this last century, the fact that the communists in China killed about 80 million or more of their own people. And, of course, that was totally suppressed in America. The communists in Russia killed 60 million of their own people. We never talk about that. Why never do we ever talk about that? Because you're not supposed to understand the very nature of the evil that we oppose today. So go ahead and, Kathleen, of course, you've talked about the Hoxie treatment. You've talked about hydrazine sulfate. Have you gotten into any of the other treatments that have been suppressed in America?
Well, one of my favorites is Dr. Brzezinski down in Texas.
Right. In fact, we have a four-tape set on Brzezinski with interviews with him as well. So
a phenomenal story. I mean, this man was, he was a genius. He was brilliant. He was a student in Poland. He'd earned a PhD and an MD by the age of 24. But because he was in a totalitarian state, he was suppressed, and he figured by coming to America, you know, where it's free, that he could do good works and do whatever he wanted to do and bring it to the public floor and you know, help people. And he began research. He came to Texas and he began researching polypeptides and their anti-cancer properties. And he got a grant from the National Cancer Institute. He published a paper in 1974, I believe, stating that peptides that he discovered had demonstrated a remarkable ability to inhibit the DNA of cancer cells, preventing them from spreading. And he called his peptides anti-neoplasms. He began trials on 21 patients. The therapy demonstrated profound anti-tumor activity without toxicity, which is so important when you're fighting cancer. His findings were published, and at that point, once his findings were published, that's when he was attacked. He was raided by FDA agents in flak jackets. U.S. Marshals came with them. All of this because he had something that would help in the fight for cancer.
And I think any of you listeners would like to hear that four-tape set for on Dr. Brzezinski. It's the most incredible, heart-rending story you've ever heard. And we have the father of one of these boys who was actually, they would not allow him to have the treatment unless he went back and forced his son to have the radiation, which, of course, destroyed the child's brain, because in the early formative stage, radiation can knock off 25 points from the IQ. And, of course, the FDA said, no, you can't. You cannot have this treatment. We won't let you. And, of course, Dr. Brzezinski, literally at their mercy, would not give the treatment without FDA approval. But this is the sort of thing we're really up against in America. And
you're talking about the Thomas Navarro story.
Right, that Thomas Navarro.
Wasn't
I have an interview
that
with
tragic?
I have an interview with Mr. Navarro. So we have a four-tape set on Brzezinski. So we have all these four-tape sets, ladies and gentlemen. You need to get them. You need to help us get the truth out. There really are evil and wicked people. And, of course, it's not most people mistake this whole thing. They think that we are withholding treatment so that drug companies can make money. Well, that may be a factor. But the real thing is there is a population control agenda out there. And they really believe that there are too many people in the world, and they've got to die of something. They might as well die of cancer. And you want to hear this story. We have all of these stories. You need to help us, because the next person who gets cancer could very well be one of your loved ones. And, of course, they're covering up the relationship between first trimester abortion and the breast carcinoma, and they know very well there's an abortion. Do you realize that one in three lesbians gets breast cancer? Have you ever heard that on the major media? Are they actively suppressing that as well? Why? Well, because, of course, if women knew that, young girls knew that, many of them would be afraid to get involved in a lesbian relationship. And, of course, they're actively encouraging it. Why? Because most lesbians don't have children. And, of course, many of them are going to die very, very young because of the breast cancer. We're involved, really, with an incredible story. Well, here I'm doing all the talking. You go ahead, Kathleen.
Well, you know, when I was doing research for my book, because I not only wanted to tell our story, but I wanted to tell some of the other stories that I knew were out there about the Laetril and Krabiazin and Joe Gold's and Brzezinski's works and so forth. And another thing that I stumbled over
ECAC is another treatment too.
ECAC is another one. I mean, right. There are dozens of them. But, you know,
all being suppressed, and actively anybody who tries to utilize these to help people, of course, will feel the wrath of the government come down on them.
Exactly. And when I started getting into some of the statistics and started realizing the numbers of people that are dying, not just from cancer, but from our health care system in this country, biggest country, you know, supposedly the best country in the world for medical care. People come from all over the world to our hospital centers here. But when you start researching, and all of the information that I put in my book came from the government's own documents. It wasn't from anywhere else but government information. And, you know, I discovered things like 108,000 people die every year from prescription drug errors. 80,000 people die from hospital contracted infections. 20,000 deaths come from other errors in hospitals. 12,000 deaths from hospital medication errors. 7,000 deaths from unnecessary surgeries. And then you go to outpatient care, which is just as bad, if not worse. You got a 116 million extra hospital visits because of bad outpatient care, 77 million extra written prescriptions, 17 million emergency room visits because of bad outpatient care, 8 million short-term hospital stays, 3 million long-term hospital stays, 199,000 additional deaths in this country just because you went to an outpatient treatment center. That's 426,000 people a year dying, plus another 535,000 dying just from cancer alone.
Now, of course,
it's genocide.
But, of course, what you're saying is all these people die, but you're getting these statistics from the government, and you know you can't trust the government.
No, I'm sure the numbers are much higher.
Well, I'm not really sure. I really think that I can tell you that the years we practiced medicine, we had, in our area, we had very good medicine because we made sure that everybody did practice quality medicine. But once the government got into this, and once the government, you see, you're going to the government for statistics, the solution to your problem you're laying out is more government control.
Well, that's exactly right.
Right, and that's the worst thing we could possibly do, because the government has actually created most of the problems that face medicine today. Hey, we're out of time. Will you have a parting thought for our listeners?
Yes, I do, and I guess that parting thought really has to be you've got to take charge of your own life, in particular when you're talking about your own health, and you've got to educate yourselves by reading books. There are wonderful books and magazines out there that are devoted to alternatives. And they're not all just hokey things, which many people think alternatives are. I, for one, know that for sure just because of what's happened to me. And now with all the research I've done, I've become so much more learned in ways that I can help my body and keep my immune system up so that I won't get a lot of these diseases, hopefully, that are running around out there. You don't want to go into a hospital today. It's a dangerous place to be. Take care and learn and educate yourself.
All right, fine. Well, thank you. Our guest has been Kathleen Dole. Her book, The Cancer Cover-Up, you can go to CassandraBooks.com. That's CassandraBooks.com or cancer-coverup.com. Thanks so much for being with us, Kathleen.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who are listening to our program for your help and your support. And if you believe that you're going to hear things differently here than you're going to hear elsewhere, if you believe there may even be some truth to what you heard tonight, we hope that many of you will decide right now you want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us get the truth out. Now, if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, and our latest newsletter, the April newsletter, deals with at least some of what we've talked about tonight. It is one of the most shocking and revealing newsletters I've ever written, and as you know, I write one every month, but then it always seems each month that I feel that way. Our March newsletter, I would be glad to let you have, deals with the real story of why we went into Iraq. And, of course, who planned this back in 1997? And we give you all the documentation for everything we say, so you'll know what this is really about. And then, of course, we hope that many of you out there will go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs on a regular basis. You can listen to them, and you'll actually hear the program 5 hours a day if you want to. There are all sorts of archives you can hook up with the other networks that we do work on, and we hope that you'll tell others, tell your friends about Radio Liberty, tell them about the website, pull down our newsletters, pull down the other articles that are up there, and help us get the truth out across America. Because if the American people expect to be both ignorant and free in a state of civilization, they expect it what never was and never will be. Actually, Thomas Jefferson said that, but I believe that's absolutely true. There is no way we can maintain our freedom. And you have to understand that you're not going to get much of this from the controlled medium. And, of course, the things that you do get, many things off the Internet are very good, but many of it is frank disinformation that is put up intentionally to confuse you. So our plea is, please try to find out what's going on and help us to get the truth out across America from sea to shining sea. So we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure. So we ask you then, of course, to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers. We ask you to pray for revival in America, because this is truly a spiritual battle. And, of course, pray for my ministry, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening, when we'll be back with you, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Good evening, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls right now, because we have with us a very special guest and a special friend, Chuck Missler from Koinonia House up there in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Chuck, how are you doing tonight?
Stan, I'm doing great. It's always a delight to be with you, old friend.
Well, it certainly is. Oh, I wanted to talk a little tonight about something in one of your recent tape series. My wife was telling me about the Nephilim, and I just thought it was so fascinating, and your views on this. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about this, because, you know, there's so much out there, and you've studied this. I know you've studied some of the strange things that have happened, and, of course, the spiritual battle we're in, but where do the Nephilim fit into this?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Stan, that there's many people who take the Bible very seriously, as we do, still are surprisingly uninformed about Genesis chapter 6 and the implications thereof. It's fascinating to me to discover that most seminaries and many Bible colleges and the rest teach a view of Genesis 6 that most people have been taught that is totally undefendable from the scripture. In Genesis chapter 6, it recounts that it says when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and so on, that the son, the B'nai HaElohim, that is the sons of God, came down among the daughters of men and generated an offspring. The offspring are known as the Nephilim. Now, it's interesting that the view of this passage among all the ancient rabbis in the Old Testament, and also the early church up until the 5th century, recognized it for what it really says. That is, the term for sons of God is a translation of the term B'nai HaElohim, which is the term used and always consistently used in the Old Testament for angels. And even the Hebrew experts, when they translated the Old Testament into Greek in the 3rd century before Christ, used that very term. And anyway, the net of it is that what this really involves, and it sounds so spooky that many people are embarrassed by it, but what it involves is that there were fallen angels. We're not talking about the good guys. We're talking about angels that fell with Satan, apparently had a strategy of attempting to corrupt the human race to avoid the plan of redemption that God had in mind with the ultimate Messiah and so on. So it turns out that they cohabited with women and somehow generated an offspring that happened to be giants, and that's the way it's translated in the English Bible. But the word actually in the Hebrew is Nephilim. It comes from the Hebrew word Nephal, or the fallen ones. And the Greek equivalent term that was translated was the earthborn. But anyway, the point is that this is the reason that the flood of Noah came. Now you say, gee, why are we getting into all of this? Well, it turns out that when you get to the New Testament and Jesus was, his disciples asked him about his second coming, he gives them a confidential briefing that's recorded in Matthew 24 and Mark 13 and Luke 21. And one of the strange remarks he makes, he says, as the days of Noah were, so shall the days of the coming of the Son of Man be. Now, what he meant, most people assume what he meant, is simply that it was going to be business as usual right up until the, just like in the flood, it was business as usual until the flood came. But many scholars recognize that in order to understand what he meant, you need to understand what was occurring in the days of Noah. And when you study carefully Genesis 6, you discover that there's this whole strange issue of these supernatural hybrids, if you will. In fact, one of the distinctives, in verse 9 of Genesis 6, it points out one of the distinctives of Noah is that his genealogy was not corrupted. Well, anyway, as you get into all of this, what you also discover is the legends of equivalent antics, if you will, are embodied in virtually every mythology of every ancient race on the planet Earth. This, of course, is the dynamic that's behind the famous Greek demigods, the gods and the men, you know, the half men, what they call titans, were half men, half women. Hercules was in Hebrew would be called a Nephilim. Atlas was a Nephilim, But as you study not just the Greeks, but the Persians, in fact, even the American Indians have legends of the so-called star people that came down and so forth. The Indians had a fear of the six-fingered people. That's why always when they met a stranger, they held up their hand. So the point is, there's a whole background here that is, on the one hand, strange, and that's why many people sort of skirt it and avoid it when they study their Bible or get into some of these studies. And yet, if you confront the text frankly, not just in Genesis 6, but all through the Bible, you find this theme repeated, commented on, and so forth. And so, now the reason it comes up as a topic is that there are people that are beginning to suspect that these reportings of not only UFOs, but reporting of abductions have many of the characteristics that seem to suggest that this may have been what Jesus was pointing to, because we see an increase in these stories. They're too bizarre to accept on face value on the one hand, and yet there are evidences accumulating that there's some substance to it. Let me also emphasize that this is an area that's hard to research because there's so much nonsense, so many hoaxes and other things and so forth, that it's hard to sift through that. When you do sift through that, you discover there are clear reports of these things. In fact, it may surprise the listening audience to realize that there's no less than 13 of our NASA astronauts that have gone public and indicated that these things are real. So the whole UFO area is an area that's been very discredited in the minds of many. On the other hand, it turns out that there's some very, very serious evidence is behind the scenes, and that's really the area we just plunge into, Stan. I don't know if I'm babbling on.
No, no, you're doing just fine. Of course, the thing is that when we talk about UFOs, the question is, you know, which planet did they come from? And people believe that they came from other galaxies, you know, and the space ships.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, you know, and when you read a Chuck's book on the alien abductions, you realize, of course, that he has come to the conclusion that so many of the people who study this have, many of the people, even not necessarily Christians at all. I think there was a fellow named Jacques Vallée who spent his whole life studying this, or the greater part of it. And he came to the conclusion after studying UFOs that this was a metaphysical manifestation. And we have a book called Above Talk's Secret, where the foreword is written by the former viceroy, whatever it be, of the British Air Force. And he came to that same conclusion. He said, you know, if we were doing this, I would know about it. He said there's only explanation. One explanation would be this is all metaphysical. In other words, we're talking about the supernatural. People don't like to think about supernatural. After all, we're scientists, you know, we're men of practicality, and yet there is another dimension out there, isn't there?
Well, you put your finger on the very key word. You know, the mystery about the problem with the UFOs is, first of all, they show up on multiple radars, and, you know, hallucinations, radars don't have hallucinations. Multiple radars, they leave tangible evidences, radioactivity or burnt things in the ground and so forth, so there's tangible aspects to them on the one hand. On the other hand, they violate physical laws. They go faster than the speed of sound without sonic booms. They make right-angle turns at incredible speeds that defy our normal concepts of momentum and inertia and so forth. So the point is, part of the dilemma as you get into this and start studying some of the reports and so forth is, on the one hand, they're tangible, they're for real. These aren't just delusional somehow. And on the other hand, they no way can be explained in normal physics. And J. Allen Hynek, who's probably the most distinguished of the American investigators, passed away a few years ago, and you mentioned Jacques Vallée, the Frenchman, these are probably the two of the most distinguished researchers. Both of them have apparently come to the conclusion that these are not intergalactic visitors, as is often characterized in the folklore, but rather they're hyperdimensional. One of the things that we have the benefit of today is to understand that we live, even today, all of us, in more than three dimensions. We know, we tangibly understand three-dimensional space, length, width, and height, a three-dimensional room, obviously. There's a fourth dimension, thanks to Einstein, he was able to resolve a number of physics problems by recognizing that there's a fourth dimension we commonly call time. He went to his death frustrated by not being able to resolve some other paradoxes, but subsequently, Kaluza and Klein and the Yang Mills, they've discovered by going to 5-6, we've discovered in effect that the most common view today in advanced physics is that we live in probably about 10 dimensions. Only 4 of them are directly measurable, and the other 6 can only be inferred indirectly. But the point is, as we begin to talk about what mathematicians would call a hyperspace, that'd be a space with more than three dimensions, there's only two kinds of people that can really deal with this comfortably. One is mathematicians with special training, or small children. You and I have a tough time visualizing a four-dimensional cube or a five-dimensional cube. You can represent it mathematically, and you can also infer some of its behavior. And one of the things that most of the serious investigators on the UFO thing have come to the conclusion that these things are somehow hyperdimensional. That is, they have the ability to transcend the dimensionality that you and I live in.
In other words, they can go from one dimension, the dimensions that we live in, into another dimension simply as well.
Exactly. And because that also deals with another mystery. One of the mysteries of the UFOs is, where are they when they're not being observed? In other words, there's many, many cases, especially in recent years, where tens of thousands of people have seen them simultaneously over Mexico City and so forth. Well, the point is, where are they when they're not being seen? And that's part of the mystery. That's the flip side of the mystery, if you will, about them. But the thing that's brought this all to a head, in a sense, is the discovery that there's an incredible percentage of our population, some estimates are like as many as maybe 2 or 3% of the population, believe that they have been subjected to an abduction of some kind. And what's disturbing about these stories or these reports is they're too bizarre to accept on the one hand, and yet they're too consistent to ignore. And they've also profiled thousands of these kinds of people where they're all above the typical profiles are above average intelligence, have had no prior psychiatric history, yet clearly have been subjected to some kind of trauma. And the stories take all slightly different forms, but they all tend to involve an abduction and apparently intrusive medical experiments conducted during the abduction, typically involving in some way the human reproductive cycle. It's almost as if these beings, whatever they are attempting to gather data about the human reproductive process. So some of the, now we're moving out in the fringe here, but I figure we'll stir it up to get some phone calls. There are people that believe, there are some serious investigators that believe that these beings are real and that they are somehow, they have an agenda of trying to create once again some kind of hybrid. And to give you an example of just one such reporter, there's a guy by the name of Dr. John Mack. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning author. He is the head of psychiatry for the hospital at Harvard. And he has indicated in publications that he personally has dealt with 76 of these cases. He is convinced that these beings are real and they have such an agenda. They had a major conference at MIT that he co-chaired. And he challenged, among other things, he challenged the attendees to that conference. He says, if what these people are saying is happening to them isn't happening, what is? Because these stories are so, and these are people that are not trying to disclose these things. Most people, it has to be drawn out of them because they know they'll be tagged as weird if it comes out what they apparently have experienced. So it's not like they're looking for publicity, quite the contrary. And yet, as one starts investigating these things, you find a consistency among the reports that's really quite alarming, quite disturbing. So there's two parts to the story. The UFO thing is part of it, and most people have some familiarity, at least with the folklore about that. But the deeper part, the more troubling part of this, is the increasing frequency of people who've had some kind of encounter that would seem, at least, to involve an abduction and some intrusive procedures. And I happen to be acquainted with some cases where there is lesion. That is, there's tangible evidence of the medical intrusion. So these things are pretty spooky. And so you've chosen a topic tonight, Stan. Unlike you've had a willingness, I know over the years, to take advantage of your intensive study of what I'll call the geopolitical side of our strategic horizon. But tonight we're venturing into to an area that, I'm sure that some of your listeners think, what on earth has Dr. Stan done this time? Who is this character?
Well, I'll tell you what. If you're out there in the listening audience, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And of course, Chuck, I've known for many years. He's a very, very responsible individual, has been in business. He is in the ministry full-time now. But as you begin to analyze what we're talking about, you become aware of the fact that there really is another dimension out there. And this is the difficult thing. Most Christians don't want to accept that. In fact, I know Chuck was commissioned by one of the major Christian publishing houses to write this book on alien abduction until they saw it. And at that point, they weren't about to touch this. Because, you see, the average Christian doesn't, you're not supposed to talk about this sort of thing in church. You're not supposed to talk, you're not supposed to get it off into this because it's too kooky. Well, let me tell you, on the other side, I mean, you can go to Art Bell, or now that Art's off the air, they have these other programs. And, of course, so many people are fascinated by it, but I will tell you that they're not going to allow anybody from a straight mainline Christian the point of view to come onto these programs and explain that this is all a manifestation, in my estimation, of this eternal struggle between God and Satan, and Satan has his fallen angels and his demons, and that, of course, they are able to transcend time and space, and, of course, there was nothing they would like better than to be able to once again create something like the Nephilim. And this is why, you know, I'm so fascinated, because as you pointed out so well, it's almost as if they're once again trying to reproduce these beings that were here at so many, many years ago, as it was in the times of Noah.
You know, Stan, I was startled to discover that this whole issue of Genesis 6 is important to understand, not just because of its implications just in terms of understanding Genesis 6. I discovered as I got into it further that they were not then, this didn't occur just at the flood of Noah. That was very intensive there. But we discover that the scripture says they also occurred after that, verse 4 of Genesis 6. And I discovered that you can't really understand much of the Old Testament unless you understand who the Rephaim are. It turns out when Joshua entered the land and that seven-year conquest of the land of Canaan, there were at least four tribes that he was instructed to wipe out, every man, woman, and child. And the Rephaim, the Emim, the Zimzumim, and there's a fourth one. And the point is, as you read that, as a New Testament reader, you read that, you're sort of shocked. What's going on here? Well, it turns out that same thing. It's a gene pool problem. When God told Abraham that after four centuries, his descendants would come back here and so forth, he gives them that prophecy there in Genesis 15 and then 17. That gave Satan 400 years to lay down a minefield. And when Moses sends in the 12 spies, as they call it, to check out the land, 10 of them come back with they're scared to death. Joshua and Caleb said, come on, let's go, God's on our side. But the people they didn't have faith, and so that's why they were condemned to wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. What's interesting, in Numbers 13:33, what the spies encountered were the Nephilim in the land. That's the actual word used in the text there in Numbers 13:33. So the point is, it startled me to realize that this isn't just a particular specialty area that's worthy of some study. Turns out it's pretty fundamental to really understanding a lot of what's going on in the Old Testament, and you really won't understand some of the prophecies in Daniel 2 and elsewhere if you're a student of the Bible without understanding the realities that lie behind Genesis 6.
All right, well, we've got Howard calling from Greenville. Let's see where Greenville is. This Greenville, North Carolina, South Carolina, Texas, or what Greenville are you calling from, Howard?
It's Texas.
All right, fine. Because I'll tell you what, I very often fly to Greenville, South Carolina, and my luggage usually either gets to Texas or to North Carolina. So it's good to have you with us tonight. Are you a first-time caller?
No, Dr. Stan, I've called before.
Okay, fine. A question or comment?
A question. I would like to ask Chuck if there are Nephilim living today. I note the scripture where Jesus said, in the tares and the wheat. The tares look very much like wheat, but they're not really wheat. And who planted them? And he said an enemy did. And I wonder if there are Nephilim living today.
All right, did you get the question?
Yeah, I can just barely hear him. I'm sorry.
Well, the question was, are there Nephilim living today?
And I get asked that a lot as I travel, and to be frank with you, I don't know for sure. But to be honest with you, it would not surprise me at all. This is one of the debates among the researchers, and I, to the best of my knowledge, what I suspect is that they're trying to reestablish the technology to create them. And I think what they're fighting, by the way, you say, gee, why can't they do it like they did back in Genesis 6? I suspect there's been a degeneration of the human genome, which is part of their problem that they're trying to resolve. That's why it's a controversial area. But I do think that the experiments are very, very real. Not a lot of what you hear is nonsense and hoaxes and who knows what. But behind the scenes, there are cases that are very, very real. But let's put it this way: I have not met one.
You sort of hope you don't, huh?
Exactly right. Now, one of the things we do in the book that we published called Alien Encounters, it's now in its fifth printing and it's just been revised, but that we've maintained an appendix, which is an instruction sheet, for what to do if you have an encounter. Because one of the controversies about this is I personally have publicly come to the public position that a Christian, a true Christian, cannot be abducted. And I got a call from a producer at Universal City at my office. He got the name of Tracy Tremé. He called me, and Chuck, I heard you on the radio, and I heard you. I agree. I happen to know a lot about this area because I participated in some of these projects. I found out later what the projects were. I'll come back to that. But he says, I know a lot. I know what I'm talking about, and I like what you said up until the point you said that a Christian can't be abducted. And you, Chuck, you need to check into the Andreessen affair. Well, I was quite startled with the call, but I did my homework and. There's a very famous one of the famous episodes by Betty Andreessen where she apparently was abducted. She was a 20-year Christian and a spirit-filled fellowship and all that, and yet she had an intrusive encounter. If you read the affidavit carefully, you'll discover that she was invited and accepted their invitation. Now, that may sound like I'm splitting hairs here, but that's not an abduction. And I think one of the things that if you have any background in the whole demonic area, you need to understand that part of this is one of bluff, part of this is one of authorities, and if you're in Christ, you have the authority, if you understand that you do. But I think these things are not to be sought after. I think these things are to be once you recognize we're dealing here with something that is metaphysical, it's demonic in nature, but it is very, at the same time, you know, we tend to think of demonic things as spiritual, sort of invisible, fuzzy things. No, these are very, very tangible encounters. And so one needs to recognize what you're dealing with here is an element of spiritual warfare. And I think Stan put his finger on this very early in this discussion, that that's a very, very key part of the dynamic we're dealing with. So I realize that many listeners may not be of a biblical or Christian persuasion, so this may sound really fringe and weird, but even those that do have some background here need to recognize that this is dangerous stuff.
In other words, don't ever accept an invitation. I deal with this a lot. Again, I realize, of course, that this is something that most people shouldn't get into. The only reason I touch on it is because I want you to know it's there. And
Howard, if I can just presume here, there's an aspect to his question, you know, are they around today? One of the things we can do, all of us can just do, is watch, because if our conjectures are correct, if we understand the scripture correctly, part A and part B, if we are in the time period that we're moving into, that I believe we are, then we can expect these things to be more and more manifest. In fact, a careful analysis of Daniel 2:43 implies that the presence of these creatures will be substantial enough to constitute a political constituency. Because in Daniel chapter 2, Daniel's told he interprets for us iron mixed with clay, and I won't get into the whole thing here except to point out that the clay, he says, he interprets that for us. He says, they will mingle themselves with the seed of men. Now, when he switches to a personal pronoun, the they, to mingle themselves with the seed of men, in order to do that, the they have to be something other than the seed of men, or it doesn't make logical or grammatical sense. In other words, they will mingle themselves with the seed of men, which means that they are something other than the normal seed of men. And so the hint there is that these things are around, or will be around, and they won't be just hidden around. They will be substantial enough to constitute part of the fabric of that final world empire, that the fourth empire, what scholars call the revived Roman Empire. So it's a dynamic that's very, very real. And we find allusions in the Book of Revelation that only make sense to the extent that we're dealing here with maybe clones. The other conjecture that fits the situation could be, you know, the experts tell us that the day is coming when we will have human clones, and that raises a whole bunch of other theological questions. But are they around today? Possibly. Will they be around in numbers forthcoming? I personally think so.
Okay, anything else, Howard?
Well, that's all. But when I read about people like Anton LaVey, I wonder, you know. But that's all, and thank you very much.
Fine. Thank you so much, Howard, from Greenville, Texas. And let's go to, is this Nate or Nathan?
Anton LaVey, was that what you said?
No, yeah, Anton LaVey. I don't think Anton LaVey was a Nephilim, though, because...
No, I think he's a promoter that just got in over his head.
Right. is this Nathan?
Yes.
Nathan?
Yes, this is I.
Okay, go ahead.
From actually Contra Costa. Well, you know, to your guest, hello, sir.
Yes.
I have noticed myself how the sort of denial of the UFO phenomenon comes from across the spectrum, the religious, the secular, the fundamentalists, right along with Carl Sagan. And, you know, that seems to be... And yet the ringleaders of this seem to be the establishment news media, the New York Times, that which I'm sure you would agree is probably controlled by a network of a few secret societies, or let's say, you know, a few men of great wealth. And I'm just curious if my thinking on this is correct, what possible motive would they have to suppress this? Would it be access to technology? Would it be, maybe you covered this subject in the first hour when I wasn't able to listen to your program, but can you...
Basically, what is your question, Nathan? Why is this being sort of marginalized and played down?
By what seems like an organized conspiracy, yes.
All right, fine. So they're really sort of, everything about UFOs and all of these things is just planned sort of confusion, and a lot of people are sort of demonized and marginalized when you talk about it. Would that be the point you're making?
Well, yeah, I mean, not only that, but it seems to be organized by almost like ringleaders.
All right, fine.
And Nathan, I think you're absolutely right. Now, I might mention something here. Our book is in the fifth printing, but in the first four printings, the fifth printing has a chapter the first four did not have. There is a topic that I deliberately didn't get into in the first four. Let me back up a little, Stan, if I can, because it may be relevant to all the listeners. So you understand where I'm coming from. I'm in the ministry for the last 10 years, but I've been teaching the Bible as a hobby for more than 30. I had a 30-year executive career. I have served as a director of 12 different publicly traded companies. I was chairman and CEO of six of those. Four of those were publicly traded defense contractors. So I mention this only that my own background is deeply embedded. My executive career is deeply embedded in what I'll call, for lack of a better term, the strategic arena. And there's one area that I deliberately stayed away from in the book because it was not only controversial, but it was... I felt it was kind of fringe, and that this whole area of what's called MJ-12, Majestic 12, and it is an area that there are two kinds of people: those that never heard of it, and those that know, quote in quotes, that it was just a hoax. To cut through this, I believe that MJ-12 is real. I've come to that conclusion. What we're leading up to answer your question, Nathan, is what's strange about the UFO area. Is the discovery that it enjoys a military security classification that's higher than our W-88 warheads. That's our most sensitive thermonuclear warheads. And one of the mysteries that surround the UFO thing has to do in part with what's called the Roswell incident.
All right, you're going to have to hang on to that thought. We're going to have to go to the... little break here, and then when we get back, Nathan, you're welcome to hang on, and we'll get into Roswell. We'll get into what is this all about, Majestic 12, supposedly this division of government. Their job was to cover up the truth about the UFOs. We'll be back in just a moment here on Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening, Chuck Missler from Koinonia House. And Chuck, before we go on further, because I usually get so intrigued when we talk, I forget, of course, to give you an opportunity to get out your telephone number, tell people how they can get copies of your book, and, of course, get on your website. So before we get back to the business of the evening and Nathan, let's just get your number out, your website, and information on the book.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Well, our website, I encourage anyone that's on the Internet to check it out. It's one of the oldest and largest Christian websites on the net. Our ministry is called Koinonia House, but no one can pronounce it, let alone spell it. Everyone calls us K-House. So our website is khouse.org, khouse.org. And our phone number, our 800 number during normal West Coast business hours, is 1-800-KHOUSE-1, 1-800-KHOUSE, and then the numeral 1. And our book, Alien Encounters, is in its fifth printing. It is probably available in almost any Christian bookstore, or you can just obviously get it by calling either on the Internet, on our website, or on Amazon.com, if that's your preference. And in fact, on Amazon.com, there are 17 book reviews of it. 15 are favorable. Don't bother with those. The interesting ones are the two that are very unfavorable. This one guy is really angry. He says, I read 9 chapters before discovering this was a Christian book. If you look for it in a bookstore, it won't be in the Christian section. It'll be in the New Age section. It's been deliberately packaged in the cover design and the rest of it be in a secular orientation. But it is, when you get to chapter 10, you discover what the real reality behind it all, and it is, of course, very biblically oriented. But so anyway, our website is khouse.org, and the phone number is 1-800-KHOUSE-1.
In fact, I'm just thinking I'm going to a conspiracy conference a couple of weeks. I'm a speaker there. But many of the people there will be New Age and the way who really are looking for, you know, they know there's some sort of a force behind the scenes, but they can't figure it out. And, of course, some of these people are Crowleyites and theosophists and the whole thing. And I was thinking maybe I'll order some of your books if I can get them on tape.
No, no, call me at the office and remind me, but I'll just send you a bunch there. Well, on these,
well, I'd really appreciate that. But really, I think what a wonderful opportunity to get them in the hands of the people who really need to know that they're on the wrong side of the system.
I'll be glad to shoot you. By the way, when you see the book, you'll notice the foreword. I was originally going to have one of the astronauts do the foreword, but I had a better idea. The foreword to the book is by Douglas J. Marr. Now, all the New Agers know his name. In fact, Publishers Weekly attributes the New Age publishing thing back in his book, A Voyage to the New World, back in the 80s. And everybody in the New Age knows his name because he's one of the early authors of that whole movement. But what they don't know is on November 9th of 1990, he became a Christian. But his name is recognized as one of the founders of New Age, and he did the foreword, a very colorfully written foreword. So the book deliberately is not manifestly one of these Christian things. But it does. Dr. Mark Eastman is my co-author. The two of us attempted to try to present a balanced view, but we don't pull our punches in terms of the conclusions we come to metaphysically, which we deal with later in the book, of course. So.
Well, I think that's wonderful, and what a wonderful opportunity to get this in the hands of some of the good people. I mean, most of the people over there who are in the New Age, they're just searching for something, and because they don't understand Christianity or they've rejected Christianity, it's sort of what I think it was not C.S. Lewis, but Chesterton, who said, you know, those who don't believe in God, it's not that they believe in nothing, it's that they'll believe in anything. And
exactly right.
This is exactly what it is. Well, let's get back to Nathan, who's patiently waiting on the line. And I interrupted you as you were going. Do you remember where you were when
I was going to make the point, first of all, that we know today, I know in some parts where I can't disclose what I know, but I happen to be quite confident that the military is deeply involved. Exactly how or why, it would be strictly a wild conjecture. I have no idea. He's asking about motivation. I wouldn't know what it is. But just for the sake of listeners that might not know what the Roswell incident, let me just encapsulate it and then tell you what we've discovered in the last few months. Basically, in July 4th of 1947, some object landed near Roswell, New Mexico, and the sheriff contacted the Roswell Army Airfield concerning some wreckage that apparently was discovered on a guy by the name of Mac Brazel's on his ranch. Immediately, the Army... the 509th Bomb Group there is right there at Roswell nearby. They sealed off the area, confiscated everything that was there, and they issued a press release that managed to get into 30 papers that afternoon saying there was a crashed disc that had been recovered. Well, that it was only a matter of hours that a second press release from Fort Worth, that's about 400 miles away, the commanding general, Brigadier General Roger Ramey, issued a press release claiming that the officers of the 509th had made an unbelievably foolish mistake, that somehow they had incorrectly identified a weather balloon and his radar reflector as the wreckage. So that was the cover story that was issued. Anyone that knew much about it thought it was a pretty flimsy, it was pretty absurd, it was very hastily contrived. So that has fueled 50 years of conjectures and all kinds of anecdotal testimonies of various people that claim to have been involved in the stories that you heard, all kinds of weird stories, that there were four alien occupants, three dead, one alive, all kinds of variations of these unconfirmed stories. But what's interesting is that at that press release back in July 8th of 1947, there were a lot of photographers, and just not many months ago, somebody took the negatives of some of those pictures, because General Ramey happened to be clutching a sheaf of papers in his hand while he was giving the press release. And by using digital, in these 50 years, we've advanced in digital imagery and analysis, they were able to blow up and have the computer analyze the pixels of that picture, and they could discern that it was a memo that had a guy by the name of David Rudiak was able to use advanced digital enhancement. And the Associated Press carried this story, by the way, not many months ago. The phrase, the victims of the wreck and the disc they will ship, happened to be in that correspondence. So this, if you will, is regarded in recent months as the smoking gun to prove, yes, there was a cover-up. The mystery of Roswell isn't just what happened. The real mystery of Roswell, why, after over 50 years, is it still classified? two presidents and four congressmen have been unable to crack the security that surrounds the Roswell incident and its associated things. And so this comes to a legend, an urban legend, if you will, and there was even documents floating around about 20 years ago, that Harry Truman signed a memo to impanel 12 prominent people, they're all well-known people, in a panel that had the code name Majestic 12, and they were impaneled to deal with and search out this whole UFO area. And that the Majestic 12 documents circulated about 20 years ago, only to be subsequently deemed forgeries and a hoax. So most people either have never heard of MJ-12, or if they have heard about it, oh, that was that hoax back 20 years ago. What's never occurred to most of them is the best way to bury something from a security point of view is through an organized plan of disinformation. And no better way to do this than to field some documents that look pretty good and have them subsequently debunked. And from that point on, everybody knows that MJ-12 is just a hoax. That is one of the best covers, and there's for reasons I would be too lengthy to get into on this brief broadcast, I'm among the few, I suspect, that believe that Majestic 12 is real, that that whole business of the documents that have been debunked was a deliberate stratagem to hide the reality. And I'm sure it's changed its name by now, but one of the things that is very, very clear from my own involvement with the classified community, which is substantial, is that that the MJ-12, that the government involvement in the UFO area is very substantial. What its agenda is not clear to me, but it clearly included marginalizing and disparaging the area as an area of honest inquiry. And yet at the same time, if it was all hoaxes and so forth, there's no reason or to enjoy the security protection it does today.
And there's nothing to conceal, then why are they concealing would be the answer. And Nathan, did we answer your question?
Yes, you did. I can only make the comment very briefly to let you go that if there is, though, a satanic reality around this, and maybe your guest's opinion that that is the reality around this, I'm not so sure that that's the total reality around this, but there does seem to be an element of it that it is in the satanic realm. We definitely, if we want to have protection against it, we definitely have to have every aspect of our lives in the light or under God's laws. And
you will not get one bit of argument out of either one of us on that.
We have to have every aspect of our being under God's principles of monotheism, or else we will be deceived. Whether it is true that this whole phenomenon is satanic or not, that's another question.
Well, I think it's satanic. I think
entirely,
Chuck does as well. And I hope you keep listening.
We'll convince you,
Nathan. Good night. God bless you. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Are, of course, in the Santa Cruz, Monterey Bay area, 464-8295. That's 464-8295. And, of course, our guest is Chuck Messler. That conference I was talking about, the conspiracy conference, it's going to be May 24th and 25th, Memorial Day weekend, at the Marriott Hotel over in Santa Clara. If you want to know anything about it, you can go to conspiracycon.com. That's conspiracycon.com, or you can give them a call at 209-832-0999. It's going to be a two-day conference, and I suspect that as an evangelical Christian, I'll be in the minority, but that's all right. I mean, we have to, of course, be able to meet people, certainly on the battlefield of ideas, and who knows how God can use what we do and our testimony there. And if you can't come, at least pray for me, because believe me, it's sort of like going into the lion's den, and you just want to, of course, be very, very careful. You certainly don't want to, as this one woman did, invite these people into your life or these demonic forces, or go willingly. What were you going to say, Chuck?
You should, like everything else, you should bathe this in prayer. You should have some of your faithful friends make a specific point of surrounding you in prayer when you go into a situation like this, because these things, I encourage you to do it on the one hand, and yet you obviously are doing it with your head up in terms of recognizing there are dangers involved.
Oh, amen to that. In fact, I've put out a plea many times here on this radio station and various radio programs I've done to keep me in prayer that weekend, because if you can't be there to pray for me, at least pray for us, because it's going to be I think it's a unique and wonderful opportunity to reach people, good people, confused people, people who are maybe have already given themselves to the dark side, but many of them haven't. They're just, of course, searching. They're really searching. And, of course, if you reject Christianity, then where do you look? And, of course, you want to tap into this power. And there is power, but I suggest that you don't try tapping into it. Well, we've got Terry calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Terry. How are you
doing? Hi there, Christian. I'm fine.
Okay.
You know, that program, that conference coming up, a New Age conference sort of thing, if they are the typical New Age type, they may want to open the conference with oming, remind them that om is an ode to the sun god, which, of course, we know is represented by the swastika and the obelisk, which are symbols of Babylon, right? And, you know, I really like Chuck Missler and his perspective. He's got a very scientific perspective on things, and you really need that in this tracing the Nephilim. If I remember my Hislop right, Gigantus means earthbound. Is that correct?
So why did you get the last part?
Gigantus, giant.
Yes, you're right. Gigantus is
earthbound angel.
Earthbound, yeah.
So
it was transliterated giants in the English, but the Gigantus, the actual Greek root, implies earthborn. It was their equivalent to the Hebrew Nephilim, which is the fallen ones. Both pointed to the same thing.
Right.
These were hybrids. Yeah.
But it's in tracing out the Nephilim, Nimrod was one of the Nephilim, and of course his mystery religion in Babylon is most perfectly imitated by the Catholic Church, and of course every pagan religion around the globe is also offspring of that, and they all have the swastika, which represents the sun god, which Nimrod was.
Oh, now, do you have a question at all for Chuck?
Well, I was just kind of curious about in tracing out the Nephilim. The Templars, of course, were a product of the Catholic Church, and
the
Illuminati.
What's the question?
And the Illuminati and the Nazis and Joseph Mengele.
What's the question, Terry?
Well, I'm trying to get to that. But as you trace the Nephilim through those organizations, and when it lands more squarely in the future with the Nazis and Joseph Mengele, then it gets into the genetic aspect and.
No, what's the question? What's the question, though?
The Illuminati work on the genetic aspect for the psychic abilities of their offspring, and I believe that the Nephilim in this day and age are of those 13 family bloodlines.
All right, but
and
you have
they are the army of the Antichrist.
Well, let's get Chuck in here, and because that's really a sort of a dissertation, not a question. Chuck, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, we're mixing metaphors. The Nephilim, by definition, were hybrids. They're only half human.
Right.
When you talk about bloodlines and that thing, it's a whole other ballgame.
Well, that's
what I finger on a very key part of this, and that is. Babylon was the capital of the First World Empire. Nimrod very well may have been a Nephilim. What's interesting is many people who studied Bible prophecy don't realize that the Antichrist will not come out of Western Europe. He'll come out of the what used to be Assyria. And I believe it's interesting in this Iraqi Operation Iraqi Freedom, on in all the news coverage, they didn't mention, hardly ever mentioned, the most important city in Iraq, and it's not Baghdad.
Yeah.
It's 52 miles to the south. It's called Babylon, and it's being rebuilt. So as Hussein has begun. One of the things we can begin to watch, and I think it'll come over, maybe not in the next few months, but over the next few years, the Shiites are pushing hard to rebuild Babylon as an offset to the Jewish Jerusalem. But if my perceptions are correct, or I'm beginning conjectures here, I believe that Babylon will reemerge and be the capital of the return of Nimrod, not literally in a reincarnation sense, but in a geopolitical functional sense,
And he very well will either be a Nephilim or have a Nephilim connection of some kind. But that's different than exploring bloodlines. The bloodline thing is a whole other ballgame. But one of the things to put your finger on to really understand Babylon. Now, the guy that is, you mentioned Alexander Hislop's book, which is the classic back there. There's a modern one that is really well documented by Dave Hunt called The Woman Rides the Beast. And it has done an outstanding job of documenting and bringing up to date and putting in a prophetic perspective of this whole Babylonian issue. Even though Dave and I, we have a friendly disagreement, Dave doesn't see the significance of the literal Babylon being rebuilt in Iraq, but it, nevertheless, the background that he has fits it perfectly. And so it's a good, if you have Alexander Hislop's book, you'll probably want to get Dave Hunt's book, A Woman Rides the Beast, as a companion, because they really, really reveal a great deal of that very time, in fact, it's very, very timely for lots of reasons. But watch Babylon in the news. Watch. I believe that Babylon is going to reemerge over the coming years as a major centroid of power that will surprise everybody.
All right. Well, these are really the most exciting times of my lifetime, and I just want to be around for a few more years. I want to see how things are going to turn out. We've got Troy calling in from Silverthorne, Colorado. Hi, Troy. How are you doing tonight?
How are you doing? I'm actually doing pretty well. How are you doing, Chuck?
Great, Troy.
And Troy, incidentally, has set up an institute of the Constitution there in Colorado to try to teach people about not only the history of America, but the Christian history of America and the foundations of our freedom. So, you have a question for Chuck tonight, don't you?
Yeah, I was just kind of curious. Of course, these pictures, or at least the face on Mars, is there any kind of relationship with our with anything other than just being pictures, or what kind of reality is there with that?
You know, they were very convincing at first, but I'm among those that have, I think NASA has pretty well demonstrated that it's just one of those strange accidents of the way they were illuminated. There are people, Hoagland, some other guys, are still trying to say there's a cover-up and all that, that they really were man-made and all this stuff. And admittedly, on the Viking Pass that was so famous, those pictures sure looked like it, but since then they've taken additional pictures of the same area, and it's pretty. It seems pretty clear that it's just one of those strange accidents. It's not a much colorful though it may sound to tie that all to Cairo, which is the Arabic word for Mars, and the Great Pyramid, and all that stuff. There's a whole thing that you can get into, but unfortunately, I think the things come pretty unraveled. I think the pictures are just one of those strange accidents that much was made of some years ago, but since have been debunked pretty well.
All right. Anything else, Troy?
No, I just wanted to kind of check into that because I know you brought him on a couple of days ago, and I was just kind of curious, that's all.
Well, now remember, you're going to hear a lot of people as we go into this conference that I may disagree with, but I'm not going to encourage you. I agree or disagree, but I guess some people, really, they send me emails and they criticize me for putting these people on. I want you to hear this. You know where I'm coming from, and you know what I believe, I think Hoagland's fascinating, and I think, though, that he is totally misled. In other words,
I'm totally wrong. I expressed candidly, and can't regret candor, just a personal view, but you need to understand too that it's very possible that I'm wrong in that. That's just my assessment as of today.
Well, I'm going to actually go to the special programming course that he's going to put on. It's different than the regular conference, and you have to pay extra to get in. But I want to go and see all these new pictures he says he has, I hope I can get him perhaps to question some of these things, because even if there is something up there on Mars, I don't think that it means that there's extraterrestrial life. I believe that these are demonic manifestations. And, of course, these are the master deceivers. They've got every means at all of leading off on all sorts of wild goose chases. And as you said earlier, Chuck, they do that all the time. They're masters at it. They will put up something there, and then it looks so logical, and then you begin to support it. And it's put up there so that when you support it and it's discredited, then you are discredited.
Exactly. But also realize when the four disciples came to Jesus for that confidential briefing on Second Coming, he gave them a two-chapter answer. But he opens and he closes that whole presentation with the admonition, be not deceived. We need to recognize the primary weapon that Satan uses is deception.
Amen to that. Well, thanks so much for calling, Troy. Anything else you want to ask?
Oh, I just want to say, you know, the Lord's word is perfect, especially when he said Eve is the mother of all living, and all is pretty inclusive.
Will you pray for me on the weekend, 24th and 25th, because I'm going to the Lion's Den. Bye-bye, and thanks so much.
Oh, you
thanks,
bet.
Thanks, I appreciate the call.
Okay, let's go to Janice calling from Soquel, and I know who this is. Hi, Janice. How are
you? Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Oh, that's good. I wondered if you had read the article about, I was trying to find it, but I think it was in the Saturday paper, on big PM centers being built, and they have a vision of building these. One in particular, I forget where it was. That's why I tried to find the article. I think it might have been Arizona. I'm not sure. A big, huge TM center was built, and that they have this great vision how they want to build these TM centers all around the country.
Are these transcendental
yes.
meditation centers?
Yes.
I didn't see the article, but I will tell you, the occult is on the rise, and transcendental meditation is part and parcel of that. Wouldn't you agree, Chuck?
Oh, yeah, and it has many, many forms. In fact, you could even the subject we've been talking about, the UFO thing, is really properly categorized as being subsumed in that in the category of the occult. And the PM, all these things.
And it's amazing that they've got all the money in the world and the rest of us are just struggling to stay afloat.
Well, yeah. Well, it frightened me because to think that was something that was, it was definitely in the you know, future to come, and not, you know, in the near future, and that just like we're talking about in your conversation about, you know, the Nephilim and all of these kinds of things, if you have that many people who believe in the way that they are this collective conscious, you know, they don't understand what you're talking about as far as how when you invite spirits to come in, and if they're actually doing this, they are inviting spirits to come in.
They sure
so
are.
That's exactly how they come in. And, you know, I'm a person who has no doubt that there's a lot of demonic activity because just as we see God's hand in all things, we know that he has allowed evil into this world that we live in now, and it's, you know, for a time. But just that whole thing about them building these big, you know, palace, well, they're like churches. I mean, I don't like to use that word, but that's what the article was talking about, and that they are going to build more all over the country. And it was frightening to me because that, I already can see that that's going to be...
Janice, it shouldn't be frightening. Jesus told us, you know, that broad is the way.
Right.
Leads to strength.
Narrow
well, is the way.
And I know
so
that.
Going through when you see these big, fancy, broad gates, you know you got the wrong road.
Okay.
Exactly.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
Thank you for your time. Thank
okay.
you.
Let's go to Nathan calling us from Fort Worth. Is that Fort Worth, Texas?
Yes.
Okay, fine. Question or comment?
I have a question. This is sort of open-ended. I just finished reading the Book of Enoch, and that has a lot to say as far as fallen angels and Nephilim and well... It alludes to the Nephilim. I just wanted to get...
Yes, it does.
Now, the Book of Enoch is sort of a New Age book, isn't it, Chuck?
No. Well, let's back up a second. If you're talking about the Book of Enoch, as I understand it, there's a classical book called the Book of Enoch that emerged about the 2nd century before Christ, and that was very popular until about the 2nd century after Christ. It's not part of the Bible. It's not considered by scholars as part of the inspired canon and so forth, but it is a valuable book from the point of view of revealing the rabbinical beliefs in that time and the grammar and the vocabulary. That sounds trivial, but it's from that, it in effect becomes an endorsement linguistically of the very things we've been talking about that are in the Tanakh or the traditional Old Testament.
Is that what you were reading, Nathan?
Yes, that's the book I was reading.
Okay,
I didn't find anything too out of line in the Bible. I wanted to, you know, check and see if there was anything. I know it said in the preface that it was in the Ethiopian canon. I don't know what that means.
Yeah, the Ethiopian Bible has a number of interesting things in it that aren't necessarily inspired scripture. And some people also suspect that Jude, the book of Jude, quotes from the book of Enoch. What they overlook is that Jude may be quoting from the same thing that the book of Enoch is quoting from. So be careful on that score. I would not endorse the book of Enoch as being on the par with biblical records. On the other hand, it's a very useful book from a scholastic point of view because it develops and amplifies the views of the rabbis there. And we're talking several centuries before Christ. Is that this emerged, as I recall, about 200 or 300 BC, something like that.
Okay, look, thanks so very much for calling, Nathan. We're out of time. But Anything else you want to say?
Well, I just wanted to say it adds a very interesting narrative, and to look at it from a scholastic point of view rather than a biblical point of view.
Okay. Thanks so much. And Chuck, we're just about out of time. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners?
Well, I think that the thing that I think we really, the key summary from all of this is I think that you can demonstrate, in fact, that you and I are being plunged into a period of time about which the Bible says more than it does about any other period of time in history, including the time that Jesus walked the shores of Galilee or climbed the mountains of Judea. That's a preposterous statement, but I think you have to, in order to challenge that statement, if you believe that statement, you flunk the course. You need to challenge it. And you do that by doing two things. First of all, find out not what Chuck Missler or whoever says, but what the Bible says about these things. And then secondly, find out what's really going on. Now, that used to be hard to do, but not with Internet and some of the resources of talk radio like you're listening to right now and other places. But do two things. Find out what the Bible says about these things, and then find out what's really going on, and you're in for an exciting surprise. We're plunging into the greatest adventure that mankind has ever had. But you need to know what the scenario looks like to really understand what's forthcoming.
In other words, you can't understand the players without, unless, of course, you've got a program. And we've got the program. It's right there in the Holy Scriptures. Chuck, thank you so very much for being with us.
It's always fun to be with you. I appreciate it.
Good night. May the Lord be with you. Bye-bye.
And you too, my friend.
Okay, fine. Well, this is, of course, Chuck Missler, and I hope you've enjoyed the program. We just want to remind you Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We hope many of you may very well want to seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, the April newsletter deals with the cancer cover-up and so much else. The March newsletter will tell you, of course, the true story of why we went into Iraq. So remember the number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and pray for America. Pray for our leaders, for our ministers, pray for our boys over there, and pray for the Iraqi civilians who are, of course, surrounded by depleted uranium. And, of course, they're lying to us about its disastrous effects. And, of course, pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.
Because all the other lights are on.
The
lights are off, and it gets pretty dark. I was hoping someone's going to come and tell me.